Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 16th. First order of business is approval of the minutes from Wednesday, February 11th. Representative Isaacson moves approval of those minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the first bill on our agenda today is House File 180 for Representative Sanders. The chair will move House File 180 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Sanders, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What House File 180 does is, in dealing with manufactured homes, is dealing with the space between manufactured homes and says that it could be used for parking motor vehicles and other property. And it's actually a good bill here. We're just striking some other language there. The language in the statute says that you have to be at least 10 feet from the nearest adjacent manufactured home position. Sometimes that's just not a reality or a possibility in manufactured housing developments. So if you've got a driveway, if you have property next to your mobile home, we're saying it's okay to park there. Big reason for that is safety. A lot of these streets also are not as wide or large as other residential streets, and it makes it almost impossible for large fire trucks to get through the streets if there are multiple cars parked on those streets. So it's really a safety thing, and also kind of puts some of this option back into the park's hands. And we're hopefully here just cleaning up statute and hope to have your support.
Welcome to the committee. First of all, Representative Sanders, did you have any other testifiers as part of your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Mr. Bruner. He's here to answer any questions or maybe say something very brief.
Okay. Mr. Bruner.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association. As Representative Sanders described, the reason for the bill is to clean up a 1951 statute that until recently had been interpreted differently than it now is in terms of how close a resident can park their vehicle next to their home. There's been an administrative law hearing this past summer under a new interpretation. A license was revoked of a manufactured home community in Blaine over this issue of how close the vehicles were parked next to the home. Essentially, the administrative law judge told the department that they should issue a variance, and while they have the authority to certainly revoke a license and proceed, the judge recommended to the commissioner that a variance be issued, at least on this particular issue. So we're just here to try to clean up the 1951 statute.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, did you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member questions. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This actually is a good bill, and I've worked with both of the stakeholders involved in this situation, and this represents what we might say an overused term of peace in the valley, where they could come together on something and work together. Hopefully that will mean some positive things down the road as they continue to tackle some tough issues, so I hope that you'll support it. Thank you.
Representative Sanders, the voices in my head are telling me that this bill is supposed to go to the general register, not laying it over for possible inclusion. Do you have any objections to that?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, then I'll modify my motion so that House File 180 be recommended to pass and refer to the general register. Representative Lagunias.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for the testifier. Can I assume that in this day and age the mobile homes are tight enough that the fumes from a car will not seep up into the home?
Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lagunias, the situation that we're addressing, I mean, it's been going on for, 60 years in terms of, parking next to the home. So it's a matter of somebody pulling in their driveway and, getting out of their vehicle and going inside. So it's not like vehicles are being left in garages or something like that. So.
Representative Lagunias.
That wasn't my question. My question was, can I assume that the newly manufactured homes are tight enough that the exhaust from a car, somebody's warming up their car because it's 6 degrees below in Minnesota, that the homes are tight enough that fumes cannot get into the home?
Mr. Brunner.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Guinea. Yeah, the homes are very tight. They're built to, first off, the state building code as well as Energy Star. In that regard, there's not an issue.
Okay. Representative Sanders, should this bill become law, when would you want this to be effective? Because there is no effective date in the bill right now. If you'd like, I can put a line in there right now that would say date following enactment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great catch. The day following final enactment would be perfect.
Ms. Newman, members, unless there's any serious objections, I'm going to waive the 24-hour rule on this just to make when it's effective. So do you have sample language that we can you maybe say it to the committee? And
sure. Mr. Chairman and members, the amendment would be on page 3 after line 11, and it would say section effective date. This section is effective the day following final enactment.
Thank you. So the chair will move that language. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. So, members, any additional discussion? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have House File 180 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative, we got my bill, don't we? Okay. The chair moves that House File 105 be laid out, be recommended for passage and referred to the General Register. And there's an amendment that I'm going to move. I'll move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form that I would like. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. So now House File 105 is in, we've had the A2 amendment on it. Mr. Eloff, do you want to briefly describe this, or would you like me to take a stab at it first? Thank you, Mr. Eloff. So, members, right now, under current law, what happens is that there is a prohibition on advertising expenses for utilities. However, there are instances, there are examples when it's actually a good idea for utilities to be able to advertise more usage. So, for example, the area of electric vehicles or the items that are described in the A2 amendment. This gives an opportunity for utilities to offer that to get rate recovery for it, again, under the idea that it's going to be safer and cleaner and cheaper. That would be the intent of the motion. But at this point, I'm going to open up to the public. Representative Isaacson.
I'm not clear. Did you say A1 or A2?
A2.
I don't have an A2.
Well, we'll make sure that everyone gets the A2 amendment.
There's an A1.
It's the A1.
No, it's the A2 is the one I want. This one. This is the one I want. So, okay, well, we'll pass out the A2 amendment here. Sorry. Just trust me. It's okay.
Yeah.
See, I guess how we've adopted the amendment already. Oh, look at that. It's a redistricting plan.
Awesome.
Members, we'll just take a minute here and let everyone get a copy. And if it's necessary, we'll move. If it's necessary, we'll move reconsideration of the amendment. But I think once people review it, they'll see that just a better way of phrasing the original amendment, the original bill. The A1 amendment was a little bit more narrow. The A2 amendment gives it just a better policy. So we'll wait until everyone has a copy of that and has a chance to review it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman.
When was this amendment posted?
This is actually one that came in today. It was at the behest of the advocates. So I asked if there are any objections to waiving the 24-hour rule on it. If there's a problem with it, we can pull it back. But there was no objections when I raised it.
Mr. Chair, another question.
Representative Hortman.
So which sections of statute are germane to your bill when it lands on the General Register?
Whatever sections are in the bill.
Is this bill on vehicles a vehicle?
No, it's not. That's not the intent, Representative Hartman, not to be a vehicle for a vehicle, but, you know, the situation remains fluid. So this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with House File 105 as amended? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Sheldon Strom. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment, and I want to speak in favor of the bill as amended. I've been doing energy work for a long time, as you can tell by my aging appearance, and the energy systems are changing, and one thing that's changing is the electric grid is changing, and so now there are more opportunities to use the electric grid more effectively, and one of those is to use electric vehicles, which have a lot of benefits in terms of lower costs and lower emissions. In addition, there's an opportunity to use the electric grid to take advantage of low-cost resources like wind and use that energy for water heating or even space heating and store that energy. That way you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting low-cost energy, low-cost storage, and you're using a renewable energy. The other thing that's happening is that there have been a lot of improvements in heat pumps, which have allowed electric heat pumps to, in many ways, have an advantage over delivered fuel furnaces, basically propane and fuel oil. So we think this amendment is very appropriate in that it would allow utilities to promote these new strategies that are clearly in the public interest. They keep costs lower, they keep emissions down, and they help, they're part of a transition to a better integrated grid.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our bill and go to member questions. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of just understanding this better, it appears that, as you said, the advertising was not allowed before to promote it. Do you know what was the rationale behind not allowing it before?
Representative Isaacson, they were allowed to do it before, but it was not eligible for rate recovery. So if you look in the original language where it lists Subdivision 8, it says the commission shall disapprove the portion of any rate which makes an allowance directly or indirectly for expenses incurred by a public utility to provide a public advertisement, which... da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Right. And then this is an exception to that. So basically they're allowed to spend it, but I think the intent of that was we're trying to incentivize conservation, mm-hmm. but this is an example where actually we want more energy usage. Again, as an overall goal, we want to have less energy usage, but in this situation, transitioning from diesel and gasoline sure. to electrification, it saves money and it's better for pollution.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have House File 105 recommended to pass as amended and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Representative Neuberger. Representative Neuberger, before we go to your bill, I wanted to welcome some guests with us today. We have 14 young women and chaperones who are attending our committee today. This is the Minnesota Women's Foundation and the Minnesota Women's Consortium. Would you mind standing so we can give you the recognition you deserve? Welcome to the committee. And now each of you will come down for your test question. And welcome to the committee. Hopefully you enjoy your day here at the Capitol. Thanks for being here. You're up. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill forward. I'd like to move House File 639.
Representative Neuberger moves that House File 639 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Simply put, we have, as part of the Next Generation Energy Act that this body has been working on for some time, there's bound to be some road bumps and some kinks that need to be ironed out. And as we were going through some of the road bumps and some of the kinks, we noticed that there was an issue here that we thought maybe we should just address. To be completely forthright and forthcoming, I'm not here to debate any of the theories behind global warming or any of the energy, the ongoing energy debates. I'm not here to do that today. I'm strictly here today to take a look at this this piece of legislation and to see really if it's in our best interest to pursue the cost of this. and in light of its track record to date. What we're trying to do here is just to repeal a section of the law that bans the import of electricity that's generated from coal from other states. The language is pretty similar. It's pretty simple here. It's pretty forthright on lines 1.14 to 1.19. And there's a few other changes as well that would have to be made in there to bring it up to speed. But we were looking at this law, and our concern was is that this law has already had a test run. It was heard in federal court here in on our home turf in Minnesota. We didn't take it on the road anywhere, and we lost, as we know, to the state of North Dakota. They won here in St. Paul, and they basically said that that this law, it can't stand as it is. There was a fair amount of money that was poured into the defense of this section of the statute, and it is at this time in the it is being appealed. And as we are going through the budget on this, the Attorney General's office is looking to looking for about $1 million from the Commerce Department to continue the appeals process. At this point in the game, if we're looking at this law, we're wondering if that's our best use of money, is to keep pouring money into this one. And we had a number of questions come up. I know that they're budgeting $1 million for this, and hopefully someone can help me out with this. That might not be the real cost. The real cost might be much more than that. Is the cost, you know, the budgetary item, does that cover the loss of our initial lawsuit? It's my understanding that since we lost in North Dakota, we have to pay their court costs as well. So does this $1 million go to pay an unpaid bill, or is this $1 million going to be set aside for the future appeal? And if we lose that future appeal, we'll also be liable again to pay for North Dakota's court costs. So it's kind of a moving target. Are we paying $1 million for a past due bill, or are we going to be spending up to $3 million in potential legal fees for a case that's already lost once in court? And in looking at this, you know, last week Representative Winkler really inspired me on the floor to really kind of to look for areas that we could save money. And I was thinking, well, what could we do with up to $3 million if we better allocated it, or we allocated it to different use? And as all of you know, I'm in the emergency medical industry, and I spoke to some of the folks in the ambulance industry, and I asked them, I said, what could we do with an extra $1 to $3 million in the emergency medical field? And they basically said that we could, right now we're having trouble with volunteer retention, trying to get people just to work in ambulances in greater Minnesota. On a scale of 1 to 10, the subjective number of the enormity of the problem is about a 9 out of 10. An extra $1 to $3 million would bring that down to about a 4 out of 10. I also wonder sometimes, I think, what could we do with that extra $1 to $3 million if we allocated it towards long-term care or the nursing homes, instead of spending it on additional attorney fees for appeals cases for a case that we've already lost. So in the grand scheme of things, I'm looking at this as simply as a smarter way to spend less money, as we were so encouraged on the House floor last week. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative Neuber, I'm going to call on Mr. Eloff at this point to kind of talk a little bit about the history of this bill, just to kind of summarize it, and then what we'll do is we'll go to the testifiers you've had come in for the presentation of the bill. Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This legislation was first passed in 2007. I think it was the first statute that was addressing greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. And the section that House File 639 amends, Section 3, essentially gave a two-year notice to folks that after August 1st of 2009, no person shall act to increase statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions by doing one of any three activities. The first is constructing a new facility in Minnesota that's located in the state of Minnesota. The second is to import from a new large energy facility, meaning anything 50 megawatts in capacity or greater, to import from that facility that's located outside of Minnesota. And thirdly, to prohibit companies from entering into long-term contracts known as power purchase agreements to import electricity into Minnesota. This law has often been referred to as a co-moratorium. There were several exemptions to the law that gave it some flexibility. First, it exempted five known projects that were in the pipeline at the time, either being constructed or planned. And it also exempted from the prohibition any project or any utility that managed to offset from one of its existing facility the amount of carbon dioxide emissions that would result from the new project. And it can do that either through technological means or by purchasing carbon dioxide allowances from a state that had entered into a CO2 cap and trade system. And there was another off-ramp, as we like to say around here, from this legislation. Any facility that the Public Utilities Commission determined is either essential for the long-term reliability of Minnesota's electricity grid or that is necessary to allow for increased industrial electricity demand, or that would place a substantial financial burden on Minnesota ratepayers, any of those types of facility were exempted from this prohibition if the PUC made such a determination. As Representative Neuberger mentioned, as I said, this law was passed in 2007. This part of it went into effect in 2009. And in November of 2011, the state of North Dakota filed suit in district court. Not only the state of North Dakota, but also the Lignite Energy Council and three utilities that provide power to retail customers in Minnesota, Minn Kota and Basin Electric Cooperatives. And Missouri River Energy Services were also parties to the suit. And the suit was argued on the basis that this law that Minnesota passed violated the Commerce Clause to the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, which reserved to Congress the power, quote, to regulate commerce among the states, unquote. And there is something called the Dormant Commerce Clause that essentially is the negative implication of that Commerce Clause. It means that states cannot enact laws that discriminate against or unduly burden interstate commerce. And when a court is analyzing a statute to determine whether this dormant commerce clause has been violated, there are three levels of analysis. One, does the statute have what is called extraterritorial reach? That is, are the practical effects of the statute to control conduct that takes place entirely outside the border of the state that passed the law. The second level analysis is the statute discriminatory on its face or in its effects? And the third level is, does the statute unduly burden interstate commerce? The court decision, which was handed down last April, found that Minnesota statutes did have an extraterritorial reach and therefore didn't have to address either of those other two arguments. But I want to give you some flavor for why the court said what it did. And to understand that, we have to talk about MISO, which I don't think we've done much here in the Energy Committee this session. The Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator, which is, to use yet another acronym, an RTO, a Regional Transmission Organization that was developed at the federal level and has been around in the United States for a good 15 years or more. And what MISO is a consortium, essentially, of 15 states and the province of Manitoba that essentially dispatches electricity within that area. It's not the case anymore that electricity is sold from utility A or from point A to point B. What happens is all the utilities within the MISO area essentially bid all their generation resources to MISO. MISO kind of list them by price, using lowest price first, and then dispatches them to customers that need them. And this had a lot to do with the decision in this case. So the utilities bid into MISO all their generation resources. MISO dispatches them to people who are demanding it within the region. So the question comes, once everything is thrown into the pool, how can you tell where the electricity came from and regulate where it's going? And in fact, the court case quoted one of actually Minnesota's expert witnesses to that effect. And what that person says was, once the generating facility injects its output into the interconnected transmission network, the electrons move according to physical laws, unresponsive to any state law or contract provisions. And he analogized the grid to a water reservoir. And he said, if I want to buy 10 buckets of water, my chosen seller would dump in 10 buckets of water at his location, and I would take out 10 buckets of water at my location. But the molecules I take out are not the ones that the seller put in. That's exactly what MISO does, and that's exactly why this case was decided by the court the way it did. So when MISO does its job, we really can't tell where those electrons came from. For example, if a utility in North Dakota wanted to sell power to a utility in Iowa, it would have to first give all that power to MISO. And how do we know that some of it might not end up in Minnesota and be subject to Minnesota's law, to this statute? And if it were, then we're regulating a sale from North Dakota to Iowa, which the Constitution says states can't do. State of Minnesota argued that the import provisions and the power purchase agreements apply to the agreement that a Minnesota entity makes outside of the MISO market, does not apply to the transmission of electricity through MISO that is not consumed in Minnesota. But the court did not agree. Let me read you some brief excerpts of what the court said. Non-Minnesota entities that enter into long-term power purchase agreements for capacity to satisfy their non-Minnesota load cannot ensure that the electricity, when bid into the MISO market and dispatched, will not travel to and be removed in other words, increase statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions in Minnesota. This means that those entities, although located outside of Minnesota and attempting to engage in commerce with other non-Minnesota entities, must comply with Minnesota's statute. And that was kind of the crux of the decision. As Representative Neuberger mentioned, Minnesota filed an appeal last May, and the case is continuing at this point.
Excellent summary, Mr. Eloff. Thank you very much. Representative Neuberger, did you have any other testifiers as part of your presentation?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Mr. Benjamin Gerber is going to come down and speak to the committee on this matter.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on energy issues before the legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. And I think Mr. Eloff did a great job kind of going through, so took a lot of what I was going to say about some of the history of the case, which is good. You didn't want to hear it from me. We've been involved in the case. We actually filed an amicus brief with the National Mining Association at the federal district court level. And also, in concert with the National Chamber Litigation Center, filed an amicus brief. It's odd that we are supporting North Dakota's side in this case, but we believe that North Dakota's position is correct. And I think when you go through, and I won't bore you too much, because the Dormant Commerce Clause, as Bob and some of you know, that is one of those issues that law students struggle with to understand. It's not actually in the Constitution. It comes from the negative of the Commerce Clause, but it's a long-recognized constitutional provision. And I think Justice Cardozo is one of the justices that people look to for inspiration, historical justice. Our Constitution was framed upon the theory that people of the several states must sink or swim together, and that in the long run, prosperity and salvation are in union and not division. And this is really what the crux of the issue that we see, and I think Representative Neuberger is right. Whether you believe that what the state did was right or wrong, it's pretty clear that we did it the wrong way, and to me that means we did the wrong thing. When you apply these principles, the Commerce Clause was designed to establish and maintain a national common market so states couldn't restrict the free flow of goods across the country. And the Commerce Clause forbids states from regulating commerce outside their borders. That's the extraterritorial provision. And what we have here is the exact situation. And if this does go to the U.S. Supreme Court, if we don't reconcile this through the legislative process, I think this is going to be one of those cases that you're going to that law students are going to read about. And I think it's going to, unfortunately, end up in a lot of wasted costs, as we're seeing. We're not sure. We know that there is $1 million appropriated, and it's either to pay the ongoing legal fees at the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, or it's actually, I think in the next few weeks, at the district court level, it's going to come out whether Minnesota, not only did Minnesota lost, but they were ordered to pay North Dakota's legal fees. So then whether we're going to have to pay the attorneys who are in Minnesota, but pay their pay North Dakota's legal fees as well as our own, because we're going to be responsible for those costs. So, what's really concerning here too is that if you kind of took the statute and applied it differently, and this is what some of the concerns, and I'm happy to provide the amicus brief at the federal district court level or at the appellate court level to any of you. I have it electronically. Is that, you know, if you did the same thing in North Dakota or Wisconsin said that we're not going to allow renewable energy in the same manner, we would have a result that many people here who would find offensive. And that's essentially, by allowing this law to stand, another state could do that. And the Commerce Clause at its heart was to prevent states, and especially we point out in our brief, New York and California, which have a large swing over the market, if they can start controlling the flow of commerce into their state, they can set the guidelines at which states have to produce goods at or have goods travel through their state. And so, I think regardless of debating the merits, as Representative Neuberger said about climate change, I think we got this wrong, and we're going to spend a lot of money trying to defend it. And when you read Judge Nelson's federal district court opinion, it's pretty clear it's a cut and dry case. And then I think more importantly, Mr. Eloff did allude to is that North Dakota and the other plaintiffs in the case also made a pretty reasonable claim that this is preempted under the Federal Powers Act, of 1935, which set up the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to regulate the interstate electricity market. There's a good argument there that this also is preempted by FERC's jurisdiction, and then also the Clean Air Act, because this is an attempt to regulate emissions. So that Judge Nelson didn't even get to that argument. She just ruled specifically in a summary judgment motion on the Dormant Commerce Clause. So I think even if for some small, I doubt the Eighth District or Eighth Circuit is going to come out that way. Even if they did, it would likely get sent back to then flesh out these other concerns. So we'd have a long, long litigation and a lot of controversy and expenses for the state.
Representative Neuberger, do you have any additional testifiers as part of your presentation?
Not at this time.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. So we have members of the public who have signed up to testify. The first is Mr. Hottinger.
Could we ask questions of this witness?
Representative Wagenius, we will. Absolutely. Mr. Gerber, you're going to be around for questions, I assume?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. So, yeah, just want to make sure we get everyone down. So, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to appear. My name is John Hottinger, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Sierra Club in opposition to this proposal. I appreciate Mr. Eloff's summary of what's taken place. I would disagree with his emphasis on his opinion, on the opinion that was issued. But this was a proud accomplishment of the 2007 legislature, immediately after I left. And sorry, Mr. Chairman. And Governor Pawlenty and a Republican House and a Democratic senator established one of the best environmental laws in the country. It led the way, as I think was pointed out. That legislation, North Dakota contested in court, not surprisingly, because it might cost a North Dakota business some money. The court decision was issued by a single district court judge, and you're going to be asked to determine who'd win on appeal, which is really not very fair to you without the briefs, and I happen to read the chamber's brief and the brief put forward by the groups in support of the state of Minnesota, and it was my view, certainly, given my bias, but also given my legal training, that the district court judge's opinion was full of holes. I mean, just to give you an example, one of the key points the district court judge, look at 1.11 of the bill in front of you, where it says no person shall. The district court judge decided that that meant Minnesota was trying to say no person in America shall. Now, any rule of construction of statutes by a state legislature historically has said when the state legislature says no person shall, read the criminal laws, that means Minnesota people. And it says no Minnesota people or entity shall buy their electricity from a source as banned here. The judge found that was a problem with the statute because it didn't say no person in Minnesota. And that was one of the two main arguments the judge accepted. The other one dealt with, and Mr. Eliff did a good job of outlining it, that somehow we were regulating electrons as opposed to companies. That, I think, if you read both briefs and the judge's opinion, you'd have some question about it, but you haven't got that opportunity. Bottom line, it's been appealed. It's in front of the Eighth Circuit Court. The fact that all sorts of organizations from all over the country have filed amicus briefs, including the Chamber in Minnesota and the National Chamber, indicates it's an important case. So I'm wondering why we would want to interfere with the judicial process in order to cave into an activist judge who supported North Dakota, I could say, but interfere in the process because of one judge had an opinion that we shouldn't be agreeing with. We should be supporting the legislative wisdom that occurred in 2007 and Governor Plante's decision to sign the bill and defend this law. It's a law that has plenty of support. It was done by a bipartisan legislature and governor. It has provided good for Minnesota. This is at best a technicality which needs a resolution. Now, a couple of other things that I want to point out. It's been a valuable law, and I'm not going to debate the merits of it. That was done a long time ago, and it's been part of this process for a long time. Now, all I would urge you to do is we're going to have the briefs have been filed. We're likely to have a decision relatively soon, although you can never be sure. But why do we want to interfere and then concede North Dakota that $1 million instead of finding out if in reality, we have the better argument. We have a more thoughtful argument. We have a better public policy argument. And the full circuit court of appeals, or a panel of the full circuit court of appeals, will accept our position. And we will prevail and defend the good legislative process of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. And would you be available for questions, should the members of the committee ask?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Last and final one that I have on my list is Commissioner Grant. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. As you know, House File 639 strikes language from Minnesota Statute 216H.03 governing the prohibition of incremental greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. Specifically, Representative Neuberger's bill strikes language related to the importation of coal-fired electricity into Minnesota. Elimination of this language restricting importation would render the prohibition on new sources of greenhouse gases from the power sector meaningless, and therefore seriously harm Minnesota's ability to achieve its greenhouse gas reduction goals. As most committee members know, certainly after the hearing so far you do, that these provisions are the subject of a lawsuit against the state brought by the state of North Dakota and other parties. The case is currently on appeal to the Eighth Circuit with a decision expected later this year. As one of the defendants in the case, the Department of Commerce has participated in a vigorous defense of the Next Generation Energy Act and these provisions specifically. While it would be inappropriate for me to comment further on case specifics, as a defendant, the department does want to go on record in opposition to House File 639. I also want to make it clear that while the issue of whether or not Minnesota owes North Dakota its legal fees or not is the subject of a current debate, passage of this bill would end that debate. We would be on the hook for North Dakota's legal fees. So I'd be happy to take any questions now or later, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think we'll take questions later. First of all, let's see, are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill. Mr. Grant, just a couple of questions. So I voted for this bill in 2007, but the underlying facts for that bill have dramatically changed. Since 2007, renewables have gotten much cheaper. We've had the shale gas revolution take place so that there's just new coal generations being built anywhere in America, with the exception of when there's carbon sequestration, which is already exempted in this provision. And at the federal level, we now have a 111D implementation plan, which is going to be in effect, which will regulate CO2 emissions. So I'm surprised the department is against this bill, because in practicality, the bill doesn't do anything. Whether we have a prohibition on new coal imports or not, the evolution of renewable energy, natural gas, as well as the president's 111D plan, make the importation of coal extremely unlikely, and in fact, no one's doing it. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, no, I agree with all of your points. I think there are two things here. One is the principle of a state being able to regulate its own contribution to global warming emissions is an important legal precedent, and one that we hope to defend through this defense of the Next Generation Energy Act. I would also say that when we have a state implementation plan in effect and approved by EPA, as I read the statute, it would be at that point that further use of the statute would be rendered unnecessary, because we would have in place an effective carbon control policy in the state and in the country.
So from my perspective, whether Representative Neuberger's repeal happens or not, I see no effect on CO2 emissions, but I do see an effect on lawyers' wallets. Am I correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, it's important, I think, from the perspective of the principle of a state's ability to regulate in this area, that we feel defense of the act continues to be important.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grant. We've closed the public comment portion. I kind of put myself at the front of the line there, so we'll go back to the members' list here. So Mr. Gerber, Mr. Hottinger, and Commissioner Grant, if you could just be available, because I don't know if members are asking questions of you or not, but just kind of be ready. So first on the list is Representative Isaacson, then Fabian, then Hortman. Isaacson passes. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, we've talked about the legal fees and so forth, but also in the lawsuit, isn't there a provision where one of Minnesota's energy providers and so forth is going to be required to make payment back to residents or whatever, businesses and so forth, to offset the increased cost of their energy as a result of what's happened here? And what is that number?
Representative Neuberger, do you know the answer to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an excellent question, Representative Fabian. I don't know the answer to that. I could, if we have someone here, maybe Mr. Gerber could speak to that. I have heard of that, but the details of it are something I don't have off the top of my head.
Is there anyone in the public who can answer that question? I'll phone a friend of staff. Mr. Eloff, do you know the answer to that? Can you state your question again, Representative Fabian? I didn't catch it.
Well, it was my impression that because of the current law in the state of Minnesota, the perception is in North Dakota that caused rates to increase. And one of Minnesota's energy providers that provides electricity into North Dakota is increased their rates as a result of this, not just in Minnesota, but also in North Dakota. And the ratepayers in North Dakota are saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't our law, this is your law.
Right. So we are, I think that's more related, well, go ahead, Mr. Gerber, but I think it's more related to the Renewable Energy Standard, and the North Dakota Public Utilities Commission is saying that they no longer want their ratepayers to pay for the cost of our energy policy. I don't know if that's related to this section, but Mr. Gerber, if you want to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I think I understand what your question is. North Dakota does have a statute on the books that doesn't allow the consideration of externality costs when making resource decisions. Minnesota does. And I think, and I don't practice at the North Dakota Commission, but just from dockets within Minnesota and having discussions with some utilities, I think there is concern that the North Dakota Commission is becoming less tolerant of paying for Minnesota's decision or legislative and regulatory decisions that they believe have used externalities in the decision-making process. I mean, there's a few things that could result. It could result in ending up splitting up utilities, so you're requiring the Minnesota-North Dakota jurisdiction to actually become different companies. And so that would likely substantially raise costs for the Minnesota customers. So, I mean, those are some of the concerns. I don't think they've ruled yet, but I think there's definitely that problem exists.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the next question that I would have then is that if North Dakota has brought this suit forward based on whatever theirs, can we anticipate or is there any signs that other states are considering similar legal action against the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Gerber, are you aware of any power generators who are in the position of North Dakota and are considering litigation against Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of anybody. I think a lot of people, as the previous testifier said, a lot of people are waiting for the outcome. So there's the Rocky Mountain case that came out of the Ninth Circuit, which deals with ethanol, where the Ninth Circuit, to a point said, we don't really care about the Dormant Commerce Clause. It's not really real. I mean, that's an exaggeration. And so the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear it, but now there would be a split between the circuits. So if the Eighth Circuit rules with North Dakota and the Ninth Circuit has a different ruling, then it's likely the U.S. Supreme Court, if that ruling is appealed, would probably hear this. And so I think people would wait for the outcome. I think there, you know, and I'm not speaking for the environmental community because I obviously don't represent them, but there's a huge risk if the U.S. Supreme Court does rule with our side, a lot of these renewable energy standards are at risk for, you know, if they have extraterritorial pieces of language in them. So,
is that it, Representative Fabian?
Well, one last thing. Mr. Hottinger made reference to, he said, why would the legislature interfere with, you know, a pending case? I don't know that we're pioneering anything here in this situation. So I'm sure that it's happened in many, many cases in the past as well. I can't speak to them specifically, but you know, that's the role of the legislature as well in some cases. So thank you.
Representative Hortman, then Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions for Mr. Gerber and then a few questions for the author. Mr. Gerber, what do you think the outcome of the bill would be? First, let me ask you, do you believe that it moots the lawsuit?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, I think it would in this case, specifically if these provisions were removed.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerber, do you think then that it resolves the attorney fee issue in favor of Minnesota?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, so in 2011, this bill, a bill similar to this was passed. It was, I believe, vetoed by the governor. That would have for sure mooted this issue, and no attorney's fees would have been spent. I think to answer your question directly, it would be up to the district. So the federal district court, I think, hasn't ruled for sure on the attorney's fees and what would happen at the Eighth Circuit. I couldn't guess what the Eighth Circuit would do.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerber, well, in your opinion, what do you believe would happen to the attorney's fees issue? In other words, I guess I'm asking you if you support mooting the case and then eliminating the plaintiff's claim for attorney's fees.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, I think what you do hear from the governor, and we just heard from the Deputy Commissioner Grant, I think regardless of the outcome, both parties are going to appeal this. So I think no matter what happens, there's going to be more money spent, and this helps really stop I mean, if this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, or even if there's just an appeal, that's going to be a lot of money that is going to be spent on both sides, whether it's through the Minnesota Attorney General's office on their time and money, or on private attorneys representing the state of North Dakota.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Gerber, let me tell you what I surmise here. What I surmise is there's a large attorney fee award for North Dakota and the American Lignite Council and other parties, and that if we vote for this legislation today and it would become law, then there would be no opportunity for that award of attorney's fees to be reversed. So if we voted for this bill, we're saying we throw in the towel on the lawsuit and we're going to pay the other side's legal fees. Is that, am I right or am I wrong in understanding
Mr.
that?
Mr. Gerber, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoare, I said I wasn't sure exactly what the courts would do, but I think if we don't do something now, we're going to keep spending more money. So I think the one thing we know for sure is that if we don't do something now, we are going to keep spending a lot of money.
And Representative Hartman, I don't know this. I'm not a lawyer. I went to law school for half a semester. In a case where one side decides not to appeal, is that information relevant to the decision of awarding attorney fees on the previously lost case? I don't know the answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, I think if there's a lower court decision for attorney's fees and nobody appeals it, then the attorney's fee award stands. Right now, we're at the Eighth Circuit, and we're arguing two things to the Eighth Circuit. One, the district court got it wrong. And two, presumably, we shouldn't be on the hook for attorney's fees because we're going to win. And if we throw in the towel on the argument, we say we're going to lose at the Eighth Circuit, or we're choosing to lose at the Eighth Circuit. And so then we're choosing right now in this committee to pay the attorney's fees in accordance with the district court opinion. That's what I'm seeing.
Did when we lost the first case, did they award attorney's fees
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Gerber could provide more information, but I believe that motion's still pending. I believe that's what Mr. Grant testified to.
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding, I'd have to look again at the, I believe that the judge did award attorney's fees. They're still debating the amount, but that could obviously be an issue on appeal, too. So
to Mr. Gerber and to Representative Hartman, am I correct in saying the choice members of the committee have is to withdraw the litigation, in which case we would find out, Minnesota would clearly pay legal fees if we already lost the case. The amount would be determined by the courts. Or we could continue to litigate it, and if we win the case, then we would not be responsible for any of North Dakota's legal fees, just the ones we've incurred. Is that a fair statement to both of you? Have I stated this properly, Representative Hartman?
I think that's right, and I think that the important point is that us paying our own legal fees is cheaper than us paying North Dakota's legal fees, because our law firm is the Attorney General's office, and North Dakota's law firm is a pretty pricey Minneapolis outfit. So I think that it is not a money saver to vote for this bill. That's one point I want to make. Mr. Gerber, if this bill were to pass, aside from its impact on the litigation, what impact does it have in the world? What does it change? What's not allowable that previously was, or what's allowable that previously wasn't?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, I think the point was already made. You know, no one's going to be building a new coal plant in the United States, unlike there are in Europe and in Germany. They are building coal plants. It's not going to happen in this state or in any other adjoining state. And so I think, but the practical effect, which is what we were just debating, is that we will not still be spending money. And when we do use resources in the Attorney General's office, they're not free. Those have to be paid for. We pay for that staff time. And in fact, I believe the Attorney General still bills their, almost like a client, the state agency that they're using. So it's not free money. It's something that we're still spending time on. And it would hopefully free those attorneys up to do something more productive when we're not going to build a coal plant in this state. So,
Representative Hartman, one last question.
So, Mr. Gerber, what I'm hearing you say is this law doesn't change anything.
Mr. Gerber.
But this bill, if it became law.
Mr. Chair, I would disagree. That's not what I said. It would change a lot. It would stop our state from really throwing good money into a bad lawsuit that we're likely going to lose.
Representative Hartman?
Aside from the lawsuit, though, let's just set that aside, okay? Let's assume that we pass this law and we throw in the towel and we say we're going to pay the attorney's fees that North Dakota has racked up to this point in time because we're throwing in the towel. What else changes in the world? Why would we want to vote for this bill? What conduct would be legal that isn't currently legal under existing state law?
Okay, Representative Horman, I let people get away, but many times the testifier has said it doesn't, throwing in the towel doesn't mean we pay the litigation fees. That has to be litigated, and you've brought it up a couple of times. He's refuted it a couple of times. So I'm going to try to cut that portion of this conversation out, so you don't need to refute her statement on that. You've each said it. Representative Hartman said it three times. You've said it twice. The committee understands it. So if you just get to her point without refuting the fact that we're not guaranteed to pay litigation fees if we repeal this law.
So what it would do is something that's important, Mr. Chair and Representative Hartman, which is clear up some of the inconsistencies between what this law says and trying to regulate out-of-state conduct. And so there have been issues brought before the commission and brought to the Department of Commerce where utilities aren't sure if they can do something because essentially Minnesota is trying to regulate this conduct that's occurring wholly outside of our state. And so whether it's a contract with an existing coal facility between a utility that has members in Minnesota and selling to a wholly different state, it would clear up what has essentially been muddied waters by this statute.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any contracts or deals that people propose to enter into that the Minnesota Department of Commerce or the Minnesota PUC has said no to as a result of the law that you support undoing?
Mr. Gerber, I think I know the answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure the utilities have representatives that are here or the deputy commissioner could answer that.
I'm looking,
Mr. Chair, like any good lawyer, I was asking a question I knew the answer to. Nobody's been turned down for anything.
What about
nothing
Big Stone?
Has been.
What about Big Stone too?
That was exempted from the law
but
when
the
we
PUC,
passed it.
The PUC basically shot it down. So what was the rationale for it?
Mr. Chair, that was exempted from this law. So this law had no effect on Big Stone too. Then I have some. I have some questions for the author.
Representative Neuberger.
Representative Neuberger, in the beginning when you introduced this bill, you said, we think this and our concern. Who's we and who's our? Who did you work with in crafting this bill?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an excellent question. When I say we and our, I'm speaking on behalf of the 40,000 people that I represent in my district.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, did you work with anybody putting together the language on this bill?
Representative Neuberger.
No, there was no language to put together. All we did was pull up the bill and draw a line. So I didn't write anything. We just drew lines.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, so nobody's asked you to carry this bill. Nobody's come to your office and said this is a good idea or you should support this.
Besides me, no. Representative Neuberger. Representative Hartman.
I don't think he answered the question.
Sorry. Representative Neuberger, who came to you and asked you to author this bill?
We have had several discussions about just about every energy policy bill that you're going to see coming from me. If you want me to pin something down exactly, that I can't do because I have lots of bills that are going to be coming. I have some that are already out there waiting to be heard. Have I spoken to people about this bill since it's been drafted? Of course I have.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I think it's normal for proponents to come to us and ask us to throw in a bill. So I'm not asking, this isn't a gotcha question of accusing you of doing something that's not normal in the legislature every day. When I carried the Safe Routes to Schools bill, it was brought to me by the American Heart Association, for example. So what I'm asking you is, did you work with the American Lignite Council? Did you work with a coal interest group? I'm interested in who is for this bill.
Representative Hartman, the genesis of the bill was me. I went to Representative Neuberger and told him I'd like him to author this because I thought that it wasted a lot of money. And when the governor's supplemental budget came out with an additional $1 million in costs, that's where it came from. To the contrary, there are a lot of national groups, on both sides, who really like the fact that this case is before the Eighth Circuit. They view it as one of the more favorable circuits, and they view the current U.S. Supreme Court as being favorable to actually affirming the decisions for North Dakota. And while that certainly may be in the best interest of those national groups, it's not in the best interest of Minnesota to be footing a national legal bill for everybody else. So that's where the genesis of the bill came from. Representative Neuberger, do you have anything to add?
regardless of the bill, thank you, Mr. Chair. Regardless of the bill, Representative Portman, before I sit before this committee, because we're all type A, I'm gonna get as much advice as possible, as you would do, or any good representative would do. I've spoken to all kinds of people in the utility industry.
Representative Hartman, any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so my question is really to you then, rather than Representative Neuberger, since you're the one that drafted the bill. Is did somebody come to you and ask you to put this bill in the hopper?
Representative Hartman, I did not get the bill drafted. I approached Representative Neuberger and told him about the bill, and no one came to me to talk to me about repealing this bill. This seems like common sense. Representative Neuberger?
I'd like to add, I was more than happy to pick this up.
Representative Hartman.
Representative Neuberger, I have no doubt. And it's for exactly the reasons that you indicated, Mr. Chair, that I'm interested in who would be in favor of passing this legislation as opposed to seeing how things play out at the Eighth Circuit. I think when we vote on legislation, it's normal for us to know who is for it and who's against it, who's bringing the proposed draft forward, who's the moneyed interest that's requesting action on a certain topic, and I think it's normal for us to know that information. Representative Neuberger, I think that your bill, what it does is it tries to undo the most bipartisan piece of energy legislation I think that's ever been passed in Minnesota. In 2007, we passed the Next Generation Energy Act with 125-9 votes in the House, and Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty signed it. Since it's been signed in the southwest region of Minnesota, there's been a 425% increase in clean energy jobs. The average wages in those jobs are $61,500 a year. And I think that a vote in favor of this bill is both throwing in the towel and saying, let's pay really high hourly rates to North Dakota's lawyers. Let's not continue to see if we can win at the Eighth Circuit. And let's go backwards on the most significant bipartisan accomplishment of the 2007 legislature.
So Representative Hartman, you've said it four times now, and I want to get it on the record again that whether we pass this bill or not does not mean that we pay the North Dakota legal fees. And there is agreement on that from the stakeholders. So we can keep saying that over and over again, but the reality is the courts are going to make that decision. Representative Hartman, did you want to say it a fifth time?
We'll have to agree to disagree, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's a matter of fact that the court has not made a decision on it, and whether we appeal the decision to the Eighth Circuit or not, I asked the question earlier in the committee and no one gave an answer. So the absence of fact does not definitively make your point for you. But on that, you're right, we will disagree. Representative Scott, then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Deputy Commissioner Grant could answer a question for me, please.
Commissioner still here? Welcome back, Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Grant, I'm just curious if your plan is to go forward with this lawsuit and we lose it the next round, is the plan within the state to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court then? Is that what you're willing and prepared to do?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, we would have to evaluate the decision from the Eighth Circuit before deciding whether to make further appeal on the matter if we were to lose.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grant, do you have any idea what the state has invested in legal fees so far, as I think was pointed out here? Even though we have the Attorney General on this representing us, they do have to hire staff. They have to do they bill, like bill normal billable hours to the state of Minnesota then? Is that your understanding? And if so, how much has been billed?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, yes, we are using the Attorney General. They have not hired anyone beyond their current staff that I'm aware of to represent us in this case. I don't have a summary of the bill in front of me, so I can't answer that question right now.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, is it possible for us to get that kind of information from the Attorney General?
Commissioner Grant, is that public information?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. I don't know the answer, but I can find out.
Okay. Thank you.
And so the Attorney General's office, they send like billable hours to the individual departments for their litigation, and the departments pay that litigation to the Attorney General's office?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, but again, we're not the only defendant in the case, so a division of that expense is also to be resolved.
Super. Thank you. Representative Johnson and then Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do think it's impossible to know 20 years from now whether new coal plants will be built, you know, based on whether it's technology or economics or resources available. And I'm looking at a quote here from the Wisconsin Attorney General right after the judge struck down the landmark 2007 Minnesota law, and he says, "We are hoping," this is the Attorney General from North Dakota, "we are hoping over the long term to build some more coal generation units over here in North Dakota." So that's from the North Dakota Attorney General. So apparently they must have some plans in that regard, or at least thinking along those lines. And I'm also a little bit amazed or interested in the fiscal impact of attorney fees and the like with respect to the lawsuit, especially when you put it in context of the thousands, literally thousands of good-paying clean energy jobs that have resulted as a result of the message and the actuality of the 2007 clean energy law. It's amazing the new jobs that are out there, particularly in outstate Minnesota, and I think it's a direct result of the kind of work we've done here in a bipartisan manner at the legislature. So to move forward with this kind of legislation sends clearly the wrong message and also could have a real impact in the not-too-distant future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gunther and then Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eliff, could you answer questions for me? Who is North Dakota supplying power for? Is the 36 rural co-ops under Great River Energy, or who is their major customer?
Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, I'm looking through the court, the judge's decision, because that is mentioned in a couple of the cases with the utilities that are parties to the case that I mentioned. So give me a moment, please.
So, Representative Gunther, do you have a second question somewhere else?
I do. I'm kind of leading up to something. Just out of curiosity, wouldn't that create, with Great River Energy, a whole lot of lawsuits if Minnesota did win? And what would the total for those be? I think it would make the total lawyer fees for this lawsuit look like nothing.
Mr. Eliff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, the court decision specifies that 24 of Missouri River Energy Services members are located in Minnesota, and 11 from Minn Kota Power Cooperative.
Representative Isaacson and Wingenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of new to this energy stuff, and so I'm learning as we go here and kind of piecing it all together. And I guess I'm a little flummoxed about the bill. I think I understand what the author of the bill intends with this. I don't see a tangible outcome outside of whether or not Minnesota should spend the money to defend its right to assert its own laws. I don't understand any other outcome from the bill that seems to have any effect. And when the gentleman was answering the question, centered most of his answers on that we'd be wasting money defending ourselves rather than what would actually be the outcome of the legislation that would have some practical impact. And so I'm a little confused by that. And then, you know, I just did a Google search of the court case and says that the plaintiffs were not awarded attorney fees. So I was a little confused why nobody seemed to know that, and I could Google it right here. So that was a little weird. I'm just a little concerned that I would feel strongly about making sure that we were able to defend ourselves in a court case. I definitely get the sense that there's much more going on than just what this case does and the ramification it has across the nation. But I would have to echo the sentiments of Mr. Hottinger and feel like we should look at the collective wisdom of what we tried to accomplish, and that there are some bumps in the road in trying to move towards a better energy standard and making sure that we are a healthier state. And I don't know that we should fold just because someone challenges us. And so from a novice's point of view, that's kind of how I'm seeing this from the outside, and I want to share that. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius and then Scott.
Well, thank you. Representative Isaacson's kind of started off where I was going to start off, so thank you for that. It seems to me that this argument has come down to two things. Mr. Gerber said the practical effect is we need to stop spending money. And you've made that same argument. That's the practical effect of this. And on the other side, Commissioner Grant says that the key in his opposition, or in the administration's opposition, that he doesn't want the state's ability to lose the state's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So it seems to me that by not standing up for Minnesota law and defending the lawsuit, we don't want, and the outcome of this is we don't want the ability to regulate in the area of global warming gases. So basically, and Mr. Neuberger, Representative Neuberger, correct me if I'm wrong, this bill essentially pretends that global warming is not an issue. Am I right about that?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, thank you, Representative Wagenius, you've made some really good statements here. This bill does not address that argument, and to take it to that next step would be one that I'm not willing to go. All I'm trying to do is look at this specific piece of legislation and say, you know what, this is a bump in the road that just needs to be fixed. If you wanted to engage in a protracted debate about greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, well, that would be another day, another time, another bill. That's not, like I said when we first started, that's not the intent or the purpose to try to make any type of political ecological statement. What I'm trying to do is just clean up a section of statute here that needs some attention.
Representative Wagenius.
You may say that, but the practical result of what you're doing is to pretend that this is not an issue because you have not offered any alternative to controlling or regulating greenhouse gases. You're saying we don't want this alternative. But members, there's another.
Hold on. Representative Wagenius has the floor when she's done.
Representative
Wagenius has the floor when she's done. We'll come back
to
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
There's another practical effect to this bill, just reading the language. The bill says that no one can build a large energy facility in Minnesota, and that's going to stand. And it's going to be a coal plant. I mean, everybody knows that's what we're talking about. So Minnesota can't have a coal plant, but North Dakota can have coal plants. And so the jobs will be in North Dakota. We're going to continue to send our Minnesota dollars to North Dakota to pay for electricity. And we want to do that more, because that's what this bill is about. We want more coal-fired power plants in North Dakota, and we want to be able to buy more electricity from them. Already we are buying 32% of our electricity. We're importing it. That's too much. We should be more independent, create jobs here, instead of creating jobs in North Dakota. I'm sitting here in stunned silence with the Chamber of Commerce from Minnesota saying, let's create jobs in North Dakota.
Representative Neuberger, you wish to respond on a couple of points there.
I do, and I'm sorry I get like all
a couple of points there.
I do, and I'm sorry I get like all of us. We get passionate from time to time. First of all, I want to refute the statement that Representative Wagenius said that I am saying. Please don't put words in my mouth because I am not saying what you're implying that I'm saying. The whole thrust of this bill is to clean up a piece of statute again. If we want to engage in a greenhouse gas global warming debate, that's another time, that's another place, that's another venue. What we're here today to discuss is this section of the bill.
Representative Scott, then Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, how many people are employed at the Sherco plant in your district?
As of today, Neuberger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, today, there's about 850.
Most of the time during the regular cycle, there's about 350 full-time workers there. During the peak of the maintenance cycle, they can have up to 850 people full-time. These are feed-your-family union jobs.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm assuming that because Sherco is located in your district, there are offshoot jobs as well from that plant. Would I be correct in that?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, you are. There is a high-pressure steam line that goes from the power plant to a paper manufacturer that employs about another 150 full-time feed-your-family type of jobs. So I guess today you could say that we're just that one plant alone is sustaining the employment of about 1,000 people. The average economic formula for every production job is about four or five service-related jobs, gas stations, bakeries, doctor clinics, that kind of thing. So if you want to just do the real quick, fast math in your head, today at this moment in time, there's about 5,000 to 6,000 jobs that are dependent on that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so I would just hope that my friends across the aisle who have talked about all the green energy jobs would have that same concern when they're talking about closing down Sherco. Thank you.
Representative Isaacson. And then Simonson.
Just a question. Is it my understanding that there was a motion filed after the judge had not awarded the attorney fees that is subsequently different? Is that what we're saying?
Mr. Gerber or Representative Isaacson, can you restate your question? You're saying what?
So I was looking at the what appeared to be the judge's ruling. And in the judge's ruling, it said it was not awarding the plaintiff's attorney fees, and then I was wondering, was there a different motion? I'm not a lawyer, so I'm trying to learn my way through this. Is there a different motion that would come afterwards that has been filed by North Dakota seeking to recover attorney fees?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, I can't recall the exact procedural history, but it is my belief, and I can confirm it with, I can follow up with you and with the committee administrator later, that there was a motion. The judge has awarded the attorney's fees. The issue is the amount hasn't been set yet. That will be set fairly shortly, the actual amount.
Representative Isaacson.
You said the judge did award the attorney fees?
Mr. Gerber.
Yes.
Representative Isaacson.
I'm looking at the results of the case, and it says that he did not award attorney fees.
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, are you looking on a... You said you Googled it. I don't know.
Yeah, the North Dakota Attorney General's website is where I got that from.
Okay.
From
their call. Isaacson, do you have a date on the post?
I can get that. This, give me one second. I'll pull that up.
Representative Simonson will come back. Yeah. Okay. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to debate greenhouse gases today. Although maybe we can do that a different day. But I do, I think, want to throw out another option for the committee to consider. And I think we've got to put into perspective that the state of Minnesota gets sued probably just about every day because of actions of the legislature. I mean, that's part of the reality of what we do, whether it's, who doesn't really matter who's in charge. Laws are passed, they're signed by the governor, and they get challenged by different groups or by individuals, and that happens. And I think when we look at that and we consider changes to the law, which Representative Neuberger is bringing forward, you know, can the legislature intervene? Yeah, sure we can. You know, is it effective? Maybe yes, maybe no. I guess it depends on what side of the issue you're on. But I ask myself, should we intervene in the midst of a court case? And I think the answer is no. So, Mr. Chair, if you're willing to entertain it, I would like to make a motion to postpone House File 639 until a date specific.
Would you like to make that motion, or are you making that motion, Representative Simonson?
I would make that motion, Mr. Chair, if you'll entertain it.
Representative Simonson moves postponement until a date certain. Is that a debatable motion or not? Okay. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
Division, please.
Division's been called. All those in favor of the Simonson motion, please raise your hand. All those opposed? Once again, the chair's hearing is perfect. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson, back to you.
Thank you. Well, through the magic of Google, we did indeed find the right case, which I'm somewhat amazed I was able to do that. And it was in the case itself when the first judgment came down from the judge, he did not award. Mr. Gerber has informed me that there was an appeal that was already decided on that said that they then were awarded upon the appeal the attorney's fees.
But the amount has not been determined.
But the amount has not been determined, right? Okay, that's what I was just trying to understand that part of it, because I think that's it's pretty significant to this discussion, sadly, that I understand and don't ever think I would underestimate the importance of the money that's being spent in its tax dollars, right? But at the same time, I think that any citizen would tell you that it's important to defend our rights to govern ourselves. And I think that standing up for that would be pretty significant, and that is the job of the Attorney General, unlike the more expensive law firms being purchased for the purpose of this case. Thanks.
Representative Hortman, you have a closing comment?
Oh, I had another question.
Sure, go ahead.
Am I the last?
There's no one else on the list.
Representative Neuberger, do you think there's no chance, then, that we would win at the Eighth Circuit?
Representative Neuberger.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And if I was an experienced attorney, I would give you a measured response. But at this point, no, I don't have an answer for that.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the reason why I raised my hand initially was just to make the point to Representative Isaacson, the judge was a woman. So when we talk about the judge, we'd want to refer to she. Representative Neuberger, do you know what the basis of the judge's decision was?
And you should also point out to Representative Isaacson that it was a President Obama appointee as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
It was a President Obama appointee.
Representative Neuberger.
Well, that changes everything. Thank you.
So, Representative Neuberger, do you know the grounds of the decision?
Representative Neuberger.
My understanding is that it is a violation of the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution.
Representative Hortman.
Okay, my last point for today on this matter, Mr. Chair, because I'm sure we're going to pass it, so I'm sure we'll get a chance to look at it again, is that the basis for the judge's decision was that we didn't add the words "in Minnesota" at the end of Clause 2 and Clause 3. And so the clauses that Representative Neuberger is proposing to strike, if they had the words "in Minnesota," then her decision would have been different. And I think I think we're likely to win at the Eighth Circuit. We're likely to get an order that we don't have to pay anybody's attorney's fees. And the reason I think we're likely to get that order is it is nonsensical to think that every time the legislature passes a bill, we're going to add "in Minnesota" to make sure that we're clear we're not regulating the speed limit in Wisconsin and we're not regulating the speed limit in North Dakota, but when we pass laws here that we believe they pertain to Minnesota. So I think it's a states' rights issue, that the presumption is we're smart enough to know we can only legislate to affect things that happen in the borders of the state of Minnesota. So.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger, any closing comments?
Just a few short ones, because I know this has been an engaging debate here. First of all, to Representative Hortman's point, you know, two words. Well, I could take two random words and go through the Constitution in various places and do all kinds of damage. So when we talk about two words, we have to be real careful, because words are powerful. It has also come up that this was a jobs issue and there was a 425% increase in clean energy jobs. Although that might be true, we don't have real numbers, and I would be more than happy to engage in a jobs debate in a future date. With that, also I just want to make it clear to the committee and to the good people in Minnesota, there's been a lot of a discussion about this, and there's been an overriding implication that what we're trying to do here is repeal the entire Next Generation Energy Act. That is not what we're doing here. What we are doing is we're taking two sections of this statute and we're repealing it because it does not stand up in federal court on our own home turf. So in order to do that, if we can save some money, and like I said, as inspired as I was by Representative Winkler, hopefully we can either not spend that money or apply it to places that would be better spent. And with that, Mr. Chair, I surrender myself to your good graces.
For once. Yeah, just some closing comments from the chair before we vote. There's been a couple of things said today that with regards to CO2 emissions, I want to be clear, this does not impact the federal government's 111D implementation plan or the state's implementation plan of CO2 emissions. It has no guidance over that. This has no impact on the renewable energy standard. It has no impact on the solar energy standard. This is simply a matter of law that we lost before a district court case, before a President Obama appointee, and is being appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and which a lot of national groups on both sides of the issues really would like to see more litigation for billable hours. And that might be in the best interests of some certain national law firms to see the conflict go on. But from a Minnesota taxpayer perspective, there is little to no benefit. As has been testified in this committee, there are no coal-fired power plants being built. Any that would be built would likely have carbon sequestration, which is exempted from current Minnesota statute. The practical effect on emissions, on jobs, on clean energy is negligible to nil. The practical effect is on lawyers. With that, Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 639 passed and be recommended to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment or the bill is adopted. Thank you. Representative Mahoney, your timing is perfect.
They're still going over there.
You're up here, though.
I was not going to miss the
cooking. Do you want to introduce the... Why don't I give these to you and you can make the announcement.
We have conversations like this.
Yeah.
I love them.
All right. Okay, I have the committee's attention here. Representative Mahoney, you are ready to present House File 662.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. I would like to introduce House File 662 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Yeah, bang that harder.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get some attention here, folks. All right, thank you.
And Representative Mahoney. Well, the reason you want to bang that harder is that there is a whole slew of cookies here. I'm going to grab one early that I'd like to pass out. And the reason I'd like to pass these around is this is an example of what this bill does. So if the page would come, where'd they go? I'd start on, let's see, I probably got harder votes over there, so just go that way.
Losing.
was that Metzen or was that you? members, House File 662 is an appropriation bill for $300. The dollar figures aren't that important right just yet. $385,000 that are appropriated in fiscal 2016 and 385 in 2017 for the Neighborhood Development Centers. This is an organization that has a 22-year track record on helping small businesses grow, helping them start, helping immigrant I want to make sure I get my words correct. That helps small businesses that are already established and small and entrepreneurs that are trying to get established grow their business. Close to 500 small businesses today are a result of the Neighborhood Development Corporation's development centers. There are close to 500 small businesses that are in existence today, employing more than 2,500 employees, contributing about $5 million in income tax and sales tax. I could go on, but I have some testifiers. This is a organization that we've funded one way or the other in a number of different times and places in the state. And the one thing I will try to emphasize, having spent years and years in the Jobs Committee, I was instructed by someone who had spent many, many years in the Jobs Committee before I got there, that if we could get a job created in the state with government help for less than $10,000 or $12,000, that was a pretty good deal. Most of the jobs that are the subsidy or the the piece that the state funds for this organization is approximately $4,900. So this is a really very good deal for the state of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I know there's a couple of amendments, and I have one that I'd like to add in. It's the A1 amendment, and it's on page 1, line 8. And delete for the Small Business Incubator Program. And
so,
if you get this in the order that I'd like it, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. You'd like to add the A1 amendment to include with your House File 662. Further comments from the committee on A1? Hearing no comments, all those in favor of the amendment to the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That amendment carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to also address amendment number two?
My testifiers testify here, and then you can come back to questions.
Excuse me, Representative Mahoney, would you like to address amendment number two at this time as well?
I like amendment number two, and I would, although it is not my amendment, I certainly support this amendment being added to the bill.
Okay. Questions of the committee?
Representative Gunther. Number two.
Okay. Representative Gunther, would you like to explain your amendment?
I would love to. The reason I came up with the Southern and Southwestern Minnesota Initiative Fund Collaborative Pilot Project, which creates jobs in a minority community in Greater Minnesota, is because of the Neighborhood Development Center. And they came before Representative Mahoney's committee last year, or in 2013, and I thought it was great. I found out there were five programs that gave minority communities help getting jobs started, and I thought it's time that Greater Minnesota has one. We had it in 2013. It passed. The results were wonderful. They created a lot of jobs and created a lot of minority business people starting their own companies. And I have my testifiers here, but because I wanted to put this with Representative Mahoney's bill, which was the impetus for the whole bill to begin with, I decided this is a good time to put an amendment. And what I'm asking for is $200,000 for the fiscal year 2016 and $200,000 for fiscal year 2017. For the Southern and Southwestern Initiative Funds to, again, perform their magic like they did last time. And I appreciate your vote.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Mahoney, do you have any comments on this amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one thing I have learned over the years is when we try to start statewide programs, we have the potential for a much larger bureaucratic mess, if I would say so. The thing I like about this is that this is starting in one particular area to see how it works in a particular area, or in this case two, but it's still contained enough that we can actually look at it. This is something at the end of the day should be done statewide, but we've done it a lot in the urban areas, multiple places in the state. Now we're expanding it with this amendment to do a region, and if we can make sure the kinks are correct and all worked out, it should be expanded hopefully in 2 years statewide. So I support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. We have a question. Representative Metza, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Mahoney, thank you for the cookie.
That was it.
All right. Any other comments on the H2 amendment? Seeing and hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That amendment carries. Go ahead and continue on, please.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers. I'll let them introduce themselves for the record and speak to the bill.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Isabel Chancellor. I am with Neighborhood Development Center. I'm the Director of Business Services, and I've been with the organization for almost 6 years now. Prior to that, I was with a foundation that worked in rural communities and also with Native American tribal nation. So the work around entrepreneurship is very critical and very centered to what we do. The mission that we have places us in St. Paul and Minneapolis But in the last couple of years, we've also been in the suburbs, Eden Prairie, Hopkins, Brooklyn Center. The reason for this is that there's a demand there. There's a request from people that live in your particular districts, if you are in those areas, that are looking for the opportunities that entrepreneurial business can provide to them. We work with over 500 businesses. We've been able to develop these businesses, and our businesses actually, on average, has been researched, last longer than 9 years, and 9 years on average. And if you know anything about small business, it's very, very hard and usually closed by the first 5 years. So the reason that our businesses have the longevity that they do have and are able to grow and add jobs and are becoming a lot more successful is because of the support that we provide them at Neighborhood Development Center. So we do everything from training to helping people understand how to run an operation like a business, the ins and the outs. It's a 12-week course, and then we provide them one-on-one training. We continue that with lending, and we have our director of lending here, Brian. And so we do lending somewhat similar to banks, but obviously to groups that and to individuals who can't quite get to a traditional bank. And so we provide loans to these individuals, but we also have an underwriting criteria. It's very important for our businesses to be viable businesses, to be businesses that are going to create sales and pay sales taxes and all those other wonderful things that come from doing business in Minnesota. The other thing that we provide, of course, is my department, the services, everything from marketing to back-end accounting, helping people look at legal issues, leasing, and helping them to get to the point of purchasing property. Many of our businesses, about 60%, actually occupy locations along really busy corridors that were vacant, and some for many years. So it's very important that we exist. Our work is really important to the cities. And we've also replicated this particular program that we've modeled in Detroit. So Detroit has picked up this model. And we're looking to find other areas where there is a strong mix of immigrant, minority communities that are looking for opportunities that entrepreneurialism can provide. And with me is one of our star entrepreneurs, Juliet Mitchell, and she can actually provide you a little bit of more of what it's like to work with Neighborhood Development Center.
Well, Ms. Mitchell, before you testify, I have your card here, and it does not say star entrepreneur on it.
Can you? It will.
It will. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Before you start, Mr. Chair, I know you were the last one to look at the cookies. Was there enough for it to go around one more?
Absolutely.
Time?
Pass it around. It's been there really good.
Do that. So this side, you know, I could get maybe a couple votes from this side.
All right. Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Juliet Mitchell. I am the owner and CEO of Eagles Wings, LLC. That's a personal and professional development company focusing on business and social etiquette. I also do career development training. I took my initial training from NDC over 16 years ago, and as a result of 9/11, my job ended, and I refocused on the business. So not only did they help me get started, they helped me to refocus and expand my business. I've been supported in so many ways by NDC. So I haven't had to do a loan, but I would say financial support in such a way that they had programs that I couldn't afford. Otherwise, some legal services, some marketing services as well. In addition to my initial training, I go to some of the workshops that are offered, and any entrepreneur go to the program can come to those training programs as well. I have a small office on Selby Avenue, and I'm very proud to have that space, and it was because of NDC that I was in position to be able to have that office space. I've worked with several organizations in the community to employ young people, so I give them work experience training as well, and my business is beginning to grow. I continue to call on them for different services because as a company of one or a small business that only has 5 employees, you can't do everything. And so the education and training and support that we give is just invaluable. So I speak on their behalf that I hope that you will approve anything they ask for.
Well, if you're going to ask big, right?
They did last year.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney, do you have any additional testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who should testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our bill and move to members' questions. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this is a question I have wanted to ask for 30 years. So in an incubator program like this, and I don't know if it's you I ask or whoever else up here, and this is a loan program, which obviously is what government should be doing, is creating a situation where people can do better rather than just be better off, actually get something started. When the loan gets paid back, does that money then stay in the program that this kind of gets a tipping point and gets going? And do we ever do things like capturing the, obviously there's taxes that this will generate over time because you're causing commerce. Do we ever try to, does government ever try to encapsulate that? They're going, okay, this is working. Let's make sure we stay with it. I've always wondered from the outside looking in, and this seems like an appropriate time to ask that question. Does it ever work that way?
Representative Mahoney, or we can go to House Research if you want. Representative Mahoney.
I just want to make sure I understand the question correctly. Are you looking at, the first question is, do we ask for the money that we gave them back, which is, you know, or where does the loan money go? And it typically goes into a revolving loan fund?
Yes.
It typically goes
into a revolving loan fund. Those could be microloans, they can be small loans. Mm-hmm. And our average loan, I think it's about $15,000. Up to $250,000, depending on what funds we're looking at. So, yes, and we, at Neighborhood Development Center, we work with Wilder Research to study our data every 2 years. We've been doing this for many years now, to look at what the impact is, how many jobs were created, how much in sales tax was put into into Minnesota State, federally, regionally, so we look at all of those numbers, and those are numbers that are in front of you today.
Representative Luna.
Thank you. That answers the first part of the question, and that was great to hear. Then the other part was is that somebody's keeping track of the taxes that this is causing or the revenue to the government. Do they, and again, this is a general question. It isn't for this specific situation, but it applies to this situation. Do they ever go through and say, well, here's one of the benefits the state has received for taking this risk, that comes back in and helps this specific program, or does that always go into the general fund?
Ms. Newman, did you want to elaborate on that question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, the tax revenue, sales tax, income tax, corporate income tax, goes into the state general fund. And I believe there are other representatives from the Neighborhood Development Center mm-hmm. that could flesh out the other part of your question or the answer to it. But the loans that the Neighborhood Development Center makes, as those are repaid back to the money to the Development Center, state, it does not come back to the state.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Vogel and then Clark. And so we got 90 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Having been in a small town bank for many years, I can really appreciate these programs and I encourage support because the money that Representative Lunan is talking about is important. But from my perspective, what's so much more important is the management and the insights that are being gained from the people like this that are helping. You know, we talked last week with the angel investors. They also do management advising and so forth. So I think as we look at these things, we have to look at them multifaceted. And yes, the money is important, but sometimes the success of a business is not fully realized because they don't have the ability to grow and sustain themselves. And when you have people like this and organizations like this that are willing to stick with them and help them grow, that's where the jobs and the tax revenue really comes from.
Representative Clark, you get the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to
point to the handout that's here that might answer some of the questions about the actual cost benefit of this program, which I strongly support. It notes on this document, Mr. Chairman, that there are more than 2,200 people that are employed in an average wage of $12 an hour. And these businesses pay approximately $2.2 million in state income taxes annually, and more than $3.2 million in sales taxes. The last bullet point on this page, it says that employees at these businesses paid approximately $337,000 in state income taxes over the two-year period. So the cost-benefit analysis has been pretty well documented, and it's quite a stellar record. So I just wanted to point that out, Mr. Chairman. I hope that this will be a strong bipartisan vote in support of this bill.
Representative Mahoney, any closing comments?
It's a good bill. I hope the chairman includes it in his budget.
With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 662 be laid over for possible as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Mahoney, and thank you to our testifiers.
Thank you.
Members, great committee hearing. Thanks again. With that, we are adjourned.